I've learned a lot of lessons from this whole experience, and perhaps maybe the biggest lesson I've learned is that I talk too much. Thank you.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, I think that was probably good advice that we just heard from former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich.
Oh, I thought that was us saying that we talk too much.
No, I don't think that that's something that we're prepared to say as yet, but I think it probably is a good lesson for us all to take to heart.
More importantly, though, I think America, or at least the listener, which is the same thing, needs to know how we feel about Shirley Sherrod and what went on this bizarre saga this week.
Because if they didn't know how we felt, we would be the only people involved in Washington journalism who hadn't spoken about it at great length this week.
But what's fascinating about this story, and the reason I just like it so much, is that everybody looks bad in it.
Yeah, everybody covered themselves in something other than glory.
Well, I mean, it starts off, obviously, with Andrew Breitbart, the conservative blogger, puts up this tape of apparently, well, it's not apparently, it is
Shirley Sherrod. It was a legitimate clip from a speech that she gave earlier this year, recalling an incident from many years ago.
At the NAACP.
It was a speech before a group of the NAACP in Georgia.
Right.
And she told them that she was administering a program that was supposed to help poor farmers. And she got an application from one particular farmer who was white. And she felt her real responsibility was to deal with black farmers. Right. And in fact, that was the focus of her program.
And she wouldn't give whites her complete attention.
She said she didn't feel she needed to give him as much of her effort. And, of course, that's where the tape ended.
So the tape appears on Andrew Breitbart's conservative blog.
BigGovernment.com.
Fox
Big
News,
shout out
Fox
there to
News
Andrew.
Picks it up and says, wait a second, this woman should be fired.
And not just Fox News, right, but other cable news operations and many, many, many bloggers. And people are all referring to this and showing this abbreviated version of the speech and saying, wow, there's a case of racism at work.
And especially since we just heard the NAACP pass a resolution condemning parts of the Tea Party for racist behavior, then the conservatives say, wait a second.
How about this? In your own ranks, NAACP,
exactly.
Right at your own meeting.
And then the NAACP, who has always said we will not tolerate bigotry no matter where it comes from, joined the chorus in saying that Shirley Sherrod had to go.
Yes. And so in response to that fairly complete narrative on Monday afternoon, the Department of Agriculture, all the way up to Secretary Tom Vilsack, a former governor of Iowa, fairly sophisticated guy politically, pulled the trigger, told Shirley Sherrod they really thought she ought to resign. She apparently had to pull her car over in the midst of a highway and BlackBerry back her response saying, okay, if you're telling me I'm supposed to resign, and if you're telling me, as she related, that the White House is urging that this happen and President Obama wants my resignation, okay, I'll do it.
And the reason she had to do it right away
was because of the media reaction.
Well, she was told that this would be all over Glenn Beck that evening. I mean, so basically, the administration responds by firing her because they don't want Glenn Beck to have this kind of story.
That's right. Well, all right. So the administration hangs her out to dry, totally. And on Tuesday, while the story is still reverberating and all kinds of people are bloviating about what it all means, we find out that the longer version, the full version of her remarks to this NAACP group tells a very different story.
It's a story about redemption, about her life growing up and what her initial reaction might have been. But here's what she learned from decades or a lifetime of discrimination. And actually, it was a very touching, warm story that completely was deliberately obliterated by the doctored video.
Next thing you know, right there on television, we're seeing the farmer whose farm was involved, the guy who was the white farmer she was talking about, and he's saying, oh, she was lovely to us. She treated us so well. She saved our farm. Whoa, the story's taken a complete 180 and gone off in the other direction.
So everybody, almost everybody, is apologizing. NAACP is apologizing for jumping to conclusions. The Agriculture Department, Secretary Vilsack, apologizing for their haste. The only people not apologizing, even actually people on Fox News were apologizing.
Shep Smith, to his credit,
said, refused to run it.
We didn't touch it on my show because we were suspicious of the origins of the tape, and we don't think that the rest of the network should have either.
Not everybody is apologizing. Not all conservatives are apologizing. But it sends a lesson to everybody about basically what you see is not necessarily what you get.
Yes. And if you do make a mistake in haste, if you do go off half-cocked, the best thing to do is issue that mea culpa as soon as possible, back off and try to right the wrong if you possibly can. And, of course, as we do this podcast on Thursday, it's not clear exactly how this recompense is going to be made, if she's going to take her original job back or if she is going to take some different job in the Department of Agriculture. But her interest, what she wants out of all this, is to get President Obama's personal assurance that black farmers and the judgment and the settlement that was made with black farmers by the Department of Agriculture earlier this year is honored and the funds are appropriated and those farmers get their money.
Well, of course, that shouldn't change. But much of this comes down to the age-old question whether we are in this, I mean, this so trite, this post-racial atmosphere that supposedly started on January 20th, 2009, the election of Barack Obama.
Well, do you think we're in a post-racial era?
I think maybe we're in a post-nasal drip. But I mean, we're certainly not looking at race in any different spectrum. I mean, it's still the same. We're seeing it the wrong way, it seems.
Race is still an enormously divisive issue, and it is still one of the things that makes Americans more uncomfortable than anything else. And it's still one of the ways you can get everybody upset and talking in self-justifying ways and defensive ways as quickly or more quickly than any other issue. And this all happened this week, this Shirley Sherrod business all happened at a time when the oil spill story had been capped, in a sense. We don't have the oil spilling into the Gulf the way we did have, so the cable operators don't have one particular compelling video image that they can show constantly. And we had finished the jobless bill. We had finally signed into law the financial regulations rewrite that Congress has been working on for a year and a half. A lot of other big stories had come to a stop. A lot of international stories were not producing news. So suddenly there was this vacuum, there was this void, and into it came a race controversy, and it took off. It exploded.
Another component of this whole thing is the failure, I believe, of what how the media responded to this. And not so much because of race. I think it's just because it's just a sensationalist. We can't let them get to a story first. We respond because we're so afraid that we're going to be
left behind. Well, somebody else is covering something we don't have on our air, and somebody else thinks there's some kind of conspiracy if we aren't on that story. You know, this whole business about the Tea Party and NAACP and their sniping back and forth, that got another boost in terms of its newsworthiness, I suppose, when Sarah Palin weighed in on it. And she said that she utterly repudiated the idea that the Tea Party was racist. This, of course, gave everyone who follows Sarah Palin for a living a chance to giggle at the word repudiate.
Well, not so much because I think a lot of people were questioning the loyalty of her supporters, and I think that was a bad move right away.
But look, certainly put that one to rest.
Look, you know, everybody, including those liberals, were mocking Sarah Palin for repudiate, and she said it twice. She said it on the Hannity show talking about...
And she said it in her tweet.
And the tweet.
Now, I would not hold anybody responsible for anything in their tweet in terms of spelling.
Remember Boss Tweet?
Famous political fundit, wasn't he?
He was a fundit, right.
But one thing Sarah Palin still does very well is pick winners. Didn't she refute somebody in Georgia this past week?
No, she did. Matter of fact, the person she picked was not refuted by the voters. Karen Handel, the former Secretary of State. On July 12th, Sarah Palin, on her Facebook page, endorsed Karen Handel, who was down in the pack, running for the Republican nomination for governor of Georgia. Sonny Perdue cannot run again. He's term limited. So Karen Handel was not thought to be a leader in this race at all. Sarah Palin endorses her on July 12th. And on July 20th, 8 days later, she leads the Republican field in the primary.
And it's hard to attribute it to anything other than the attention that was paid to her because of Sarah Palin.
And Sarah Palin didn't even come to Georgia to campaign for
her.
It was just a Facebook. So we could make fun of the refudiating and her comparing herself to William Shakespeare all we want. The fact is she made an endorsement, as she did with Nikki Haley, as she has done elsewhere around the country, and it has made a difference. Interesting enough, the day after that she endorsed Karen Handel, Newt Gingrich endorsed another Republican in that race, Nathan
and
Deal.
And he is a Georgian.
Newt Gingrich is.
Some of us do still remember that Newt Gingrich represented Georgia in Congress.
Although not born in Georgia, I believe. I think he's
born in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, he was.
That's
born in
correct.
Pennsylvania. But anyway, so he endorsed Nathan Deal. Nathan Deal finishes second in the primary. The runoff is August 10th. And now you have a proxy. People are trying to make this a proxy battle between Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich.
Now, who would try to do that?
Well, us.
Somebody in our business.
One thing we also want to mention about endorsements in Georgia, Bill Clinton, who has been doing very well with endorsements, of course, the big one in Arkansas.
Oh, and he endorsed Hillary for president in 08.
And she's, I think he endorsed her for Secretary of State, too. But he did endorse, of course, Blanche Lincoln, made some key campaign appearances in for Mark Critz in Pennsylvania 12.
He's been a big gorilla.
But he also endorsed Thurbert Baker, the state attorney general who's African-American in Georgia, who was running against Rory Barnes, the former governor, in the Democratic primary.
That was kind of a surprise, because you would have thought that Clinton would be with Rory Barnes, a guy who was around back in Clinton's heyday.
A Clinton type of governor, but also...
Type?
But, well, then
yes, he was.
New Democrat type. So, but the thing is, Rory Barnes won that primary with 69% of the vote to 22% for Thurbert Baker, which is interesting why Clinton would pick such a...
Loser. A loser. I think what we're saying here is he chose the African-American candidate, despite the fact he must have known the guy was going to take a real beating.
Yeah.
Why did he do that?
I don't know the answer, but he lost 3-1. Pretty remarkable.
So the Peach State now has its own Mama Grizzly. Why did Sarah Palin not choose a candidate to support in West Virginia? Why didn't she get Shelley Moore Capito, who is thought by most people to be the strongest possible Republican candidate in that state for the seat left by the death of Robert C. Byrd? Why didn't she get her to run?
Well, that was a good segue. I see we were wheeling to West Virginia. That was very nice, Ron.
Wheeling to West
Virginia. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Well, here's the thing. First of all, and since we last left our listener, the state legislature in West Virginia decided that there would be a special election this year. So Joe Manchin quickly announced his candidacy. Shelley Moore Capito, the daughter of Arch Moore.
Make him spend it all, Arch.
Very good. Arch Moore, the former governor. Shelley Moore Capito would have been the strongest candidate.
The state, on the Republican side,
On the Republican side.
Yes.
The state legislature passed a codicil that allowed Shelley Moore Capito to run for both the Senate seat and re-election to her
A Capito codicil.
That's right.
You mean in the Capitol they passed a Capitol codicil?
It was the Capitol steps. Yes, exactly right. Well, anyway, it turned out she said she thought there might be a court challenge against it. She decided not to run for the Senate. She would have lost anyway. It looks like it'll be John Racey, the guy who lost to both Jay Rockefeller and Robert Byrd.
He will then be the Republican nominee. Now, this is a man who's self-financing.
Yes.
He is a businessman.
But
he can say, look, I am the perfect 2010 candidate. I am the kind of person you want to vote for if you want to register your unhappiness with Barack Obama, his anti-business attitude, the Democrats who are running the country into the ditch,
right?
Vote for John Racey.
Well, yes and no. I think West Virginia is actually in a post-Racey era. Racey has run twice, lost narrowly to Jay Rockefeller in 84, got clobbered by Robert Byrd in 2006, but he is probably the only candidate the Republican Party has. Capito, I suspect, actually wants to run for governor in 2012 to follow in her father's footsteps. But staying on the West Virginia theme, I don't want to put the cart before the horse, but let's put
in this case, before the Goodwin.
That's true. Cart Goodwin, who was appointed to the Senate, 36-year-old Cart Goodwin, who replaces the oldest senator, Robert Byrd. Cart Goodwin was sworn in as a senator from West Virginia and immediately voted for cloture.
That's right.
On the unemployment benefits.
Yeah. His first vote was the 60th vote for the jobless bill to go forward.
Oh, before we leave West Virginia again, speaking of old senators, Ken Heckler, the former congressman, former secretary of state, 95 years old, he announced his candidacy for the Democratic nomination for the Senate, running against Joe Manchin in the August 28th primary. Speaking of votes in the Senate Judiciary Committee had a vote this week on the Elena Kagan nomination.
Real nail biter, right down to the last vote, and it was 13-6.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, with a 12-7 Democratic majority in the committee, it was not a nail biter.
Oh, that would mean one of the Republicans must have voted for it.
And that's the story of the week.
And that would be Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, who seems to be auditioning for the role that John McCain used to play in the Senate, a person that the Democrats could sometimes do business with, despite his being a Republican.
Or he's auditioning for the role that Bob Inglis played, being ousted by the Republican primary by conservatives who don't like the way he's going.
I think he's asking for it in his next primary in, 2012?
2014.
Well, he's asking for it even now. But he has been playing this role, what we used to consider the John McCain role. He was
the maverick.
This was the guy they were going to deal with on immigration, the guy they were going to deal with on
climate.
And then suddenly he withdrew from all of that. He pulled back from the deals he was cutting with Joe Lieberman and John Kerry, and suddenly he wanted to be a Republican again until we came down to Kagan. I think he really feels strongly convicted of this principle that a president should have the president's choice for the Supreme Court.
No one spent more time trying to beat President Obama than I did, except maybe Senator McCain. I missed my own election. I voted absentee. But I understood we lost. President Obama won. And I've got a lot of opportunity to disagree with him. But the Constitution, in my view, puts a requirement on me as a senator to not replace my judgment for his.
That is exactly what he said with the Sotomayor nomination. He was the only Republican on Senate Judiciary in 2009 to vote for Obama's choice of Sotomayor. And yet he's very aware of a new Republican Party that will oust a Bob Inglis, that will oust a Robert Bennett in Utah, that will push a Charlie Crist out of the party.
Because, and possibly pushed Lindsey Graham right out of the Senate
as well. I don't know. I mean, he's not up until 2014. In 2008, even though there were a lot of heretical things that he had done up to 2008, he still easily won the primary then, but who knows what's going to happen by 2014? Who knows if the anger will be the same? Who knows if the conservative influence in the party will be the same?
Who knows where the time goes? One thing we do know, and that is that Rod Blagojevich is absolutely going to testify in his own defense, because for the last year and a half, he's been telling us that all he wants is the opportunity to clear his name in a court of law by speaking directly to the jury and to the world and telling them the facts. Isn't that right, Ken?
Yes. So wait a second. So I understand that the defense rested this week. Did he testify?
No.
Oh. The shame of this is I was hoping that we would hear from Rod Blagojevich, because here's a defense that made sense. Leonardo DiCaprio, as he did in the movie Inception, went into Blagojevich's brain. He put in this information, basically, that we were just, you know, what he was planning to do by putting the information.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's dreams and political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Dream when I want you, in my arms when I want you, and all your charms whenever I want you. All I have to do is dream.
Refudiate.